This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. It's going to be a big week here in Washington.
The people of Georgia are angry. The people of the country are angry. And there's nothing wrong with saying that you've recalculated.
Well, Mr. President, the challenge that you have is the data you have is wrong.
I'll make you a promise. We're going to keep fighting until every legal vote is counted.
The statements we've heard both from the president this weekend and from the vice president last week in front of a crowd of young conservatives have some folks worried. On Wednesday, Mike Pence will preside over a session of Congress that will answer a simple question laid out in the Constitution and the Electoral Count Act of 1887. Does Congress receive the state's electoral votes? Answering that question is typically as easy as checking a box, but a last-ditch effort from congressional Republicans could drag the process out even further. The election is done. It's over. But we now know the lengths the president and his supporters are prepared to go to overturn the result. And 2 months on, we now have enough definitive data to tell us just how the political landscape has shifted in the GOP's favor. Few know the numbers as well as our next guest. Dante Cheney is the director of the American Communities Project at George Washington University and the author of Our Patchwork Nation. Dante, welcome and Happy New Year.
Thank you for having me here, and Happy New Year to you, too.
So you've picked out four categories where the data suggests there's been real change. Before we get into each of them, let's start with your big takeaways from what we heard over the weekend. As you know, on Sunday, the Washington Post was the first to post audio of the president essentially haranguing Georgia's Secretary of State over the election results. How might that affect the runoffs there tomorrow?
So that's a really good question. There's this thought, I think, that Trump voters are with the president really come hell or high water, and this will, you know, this won't do anything to affect the vote. It'll just fire up his supporters more. I think the other way of thinking about it, though, is it'll fire up the opposition. And look, there are a group of voters. I know that we think if somebody's a Republican, that equals them being a Trump supporter now. There are a group of Republicans, I think, who are still party Republicans who aren't really quite sure what to make of the president. And if they haven't voted yet, I do wonder if that call gives some of those folks some pause. And if the races in Georgia, these Senate races, look anything as close as the presidential race, you know, a percentage point here or there, it could end up being decisive. But we're going to have to really wait and see to know for sure. But it could honestly play out either way.
Well, you've researched the changing political landscape in four key American places: college towns, exurbs, Hispanic centers, and military posts. Let's start with college towns. What have you found?
So in this past election, the college towns, which are places in and around mostly major universities around the country, showed a big shift toward the Democrats. And that's not a big surprise. Those places tend to vote Democratic. They shifted by about 5 points toward Joe Biden. That means his margin grew by about 5 points, 4.8 points over what Hillary Clinton got out of those places in 2016. That's not a huge surprise. What is interesting is that the percentage of the vote he got out of there was actually slightly better than what Barack Obama got. And to us, what that means, that the American Communities Project, is that there was this talk in the election about, like, well, Biden just isn't getting the enthusiasm that Obama got or that Democrats got. But that number is pretty good. I mean, he got, I think, 53% Obama in terms of the total percentage out of there compared to Obama's 54%. And that's slightly better than what Obama got in 2012, which was 52. What does that tell me? That tells me that those voters don't need to love the person they're voting for, because I don't think they're huge Joe Biden fans, but they really did not like Donald Trump. And that was enough to motivate them to come out and vote for Joe Biden. And in some states, you know, you've got big college towns, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, you've got all big college towns in those states. It really helps push the margins up and wins the state for the Democrats in those places.
So what matters most for this group? Is it the policy platform that they can get excited about, or is it that candidate who's going to get enough people to come out and vote in big numbers?
So the theory was, it was, you know, a lot of these folks were Bernie supporters. There are a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters in these places. And you know, obviously, Senator Sanders did not get the nomination. Joe Biden was thought to be too moderate for these places. I think my read of it is, as much as positive, you know, basically positive enthusiasm for the candidate, because there was a lot of positive enthusiasm for Obama in 2008, a lot of enthusiasm for Bernie Sanders in 2016 and 2020. Is important, but negative enthusiasm. These are people that really did not like Donald Trump. These communities were strong. These are young college kids. They do not like Donald Trump. Negative enthusiasm can have a huge impact in these places, and it looks like it did and really kind of propelled Biden.
Well, your second area is what you call the exurbs. Where are they and how do they trend politically?
So this may be one of the most, I think this is the most interesting finding this election. There are these places called the exurbs, and they tend to be suburban places a little further outside of the major metropolitan areas. They're near. They tend to be very white. They're not terribly diverse racially and ethnically. They're fairly well off. They're fairly well educated. I like to think of these places as kind of the home of the Republican establishment. Joe Biden did 6 points better, 5.9 points better than Hillary Clinton did in terms of margin these places. Now, that Donald Trump still won these counties, but he won them by 11 points instead of 17 points. I think what we're seeing in these places is we've long wondered if Trump's approach to policy and even really his approach to the presidency was going to turn off some of these kind of more establishment Republicans. And it really looks to me when I look at the excerpts like that's what happened in this election. I honestly thought we'd see a little bit more of this movement in 2016 in these places. We didn't. Trump won these places by about the same amount that Mitt Romney did in 2012. But there was a noticeable shift in 2020. These places really shifted away from the president. And for the Republicans long term, They need to kind of bring these voters back. This is a very problematic move.
Well, Robbie Mook, who ran Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign back in 26, believes this group has only leased its vote to the Democrats under Joe Biden. What do you make of that assessment?
Yeah, I mean, I honestly think that's a fairly good assessment. My one I would add on that, though, is their vote is leased to everybody right now. This is a group of people, a group of communities, really, that isn't really sure where they should be right now in politics in the United States. These are not Trumpy, you know, what we think of as like, you know, quote unquote Trumpy places. These are places that had ties to a Republican Party that we're not sure if it really exists anymore. So yeah, Biden, I think it's true to say he's renting them. But I think right now they're only for rent for everybody. They're not for sale yet. They're looking to see the way everything's going to shake out.
Well, the third group that grabbed your attention is one where the vote in November really did surprise a lot of folks. These are the towns and counties you call Hispanic centers. What's going on there?
This is one of the more surprising findings in the election, too. So these are places that are, large Hispanic populations. Donald Trump did 3.5 percentage points better in these communities than he did in 2016. That's probably a surprise to a lot of people because here's Trump. He has, I think, he said things that are offensive, I think, to many Hispanics. And yet he's doing 3.5 points better. What happened in these places? And the original assessment was that, like, well, what we're really seeing is like Latino voters, really Hispanic voters in Miami, Cubans and Venezuelans that have a strong kind of fear and kind of uneasiness about like socialism or communism came out and voted for Donald Trump. And that's why he did better in these places. But we see it all on the Texas border, too. And those are very different kinds of communities. Hispanic is a word that can mean a lot of different things. There are people from Central America who are Hispanic. Cubans, we are Hispanic. It's really just a language that defines that group. But the fact that we saw movement along the Texas border with really like Mexican Hispanics with Mexican ties to Mexico, some places only there for a couple generations. That was interesting. And the one thing that we don't really know what to make of it yet. We kind of need to get out and visit some of these places, which is very hard right now with what we're dealing with COVID. But one thing we're wondering is these places are, they have a lot of Hispanics in them, but they are not very diverse. They have huge numbers of Hispanics in them, some of these places. And it may be that they tend to be very small communities, fairly isolated, somewhat rural. And in some ways, they look like rural white communities. And the idea of talking about, police, defending the police and concerns about, quote unquote, defunding the police and current ideas, keeping the country safe. And also kind of dislike of urban areas, which Trump has really played up, his distrust and dislike of big cities. That might play in some of these communities. That may be something that, like, as the Republicans become a more rural community, these more rural Hispanic communities in the West, maybe they become Republican territory. But it's something we've got to dig into a lot more over the next, like, months, really, and years.
Well, the last category you say kind of fell under the radar for most people, military posts. What are those and how are they trending?
Yeah, so that was, I keep saying they're surprising. This one was, we didn't expect this. I mean, I guess we didn't expect the Hispanic move either. The others weren't terribly shocking. But this was a more than a 5-point move toward the Democratic Party in these places we call military posts. And these places are communities, they tend to be in and around large military bases, military installations. And remember, so we're talking out, that doesn't mean that just soldiers live here. That means soldiers live here, families of soldiers live here, veterans live here, people who work on bases who are not military live in these communities. And we're still trying to get our hands around what exactly happened. This military post movement, this is like 5.4 points in the Democrats' direction. Republicans still won them, but by 5.4 points fewer. Trump won them by 5.4 percentage points fewer than he did in 2016. There are a lot of these military posts in Georgia. And the question is, what is this going to mean tomorrow? Are we going to see this shift on display again when we see the vote in these two Senate races down in Georgia? It's going to be fascinating to watch.
We're talking to Dante Cheney, director of the American Communities Project at George Washington University. He's also the author of Our Patchwork Nation. Dante, stick with us for a bit. We're going to come back in just a moment. I'm Jen White. This is 1A. This is 1A. I'm Jen White. 2 months post-election, we're digging into the voting data with Dante Cheney. He's the director of the American Communities Project at George Washington University and the author of Our Patchwork Nation. Dante, before the break, you were talking about Trump as a motivating factor, either for people to vote for him or against him. But what does this mean for the political parties when Trump is not at the top of the ticket?
So that's a really good question, because when we saw in 2018, that was a very good election for Democrats, and Trump wasn't on the ticket at that point. The question is, are we still so close to the 2020 election, and as there's still so much, I mean, it doesn't feel like it's really ended if you spend any time on Twitter.
Very true.
And maybe he ends up being on the ballot for people. I mean, he's basically trying to put himself on the ballot. He's going to go down there again and speak tonight, I believe, and we're going to find out the answer to that question. And the other thing we might find out is if he's on the ballot, maybe Trump post 2020 is different. I mean, trying to put himself on the ballot, maybe Trump post 2020 election is different than Trump 2016 or even during 2020. I think we're going to learn a little bit on Tuesday night.
Well, as a demographer, you get to slice and dice the population into all types of categories. We know none of the groups we're talking about are a monolith. You can get that sense sometimes if you listen to a lot of pundits and politicians. But what kinds of traps do you have to avoid when it comes to analyzing these groups for politics?
Well, I think that's a really good way of putting it, that they're not monoliths. I mean, so the one advantage we have is because we do things at the American Communities Project, we're doing things at the geographic level. So these are types of places, not types of people. So it allows us to kind of, there's a little bit of wiggle room in there. So like college towns aren't just full of college kids. College kids are part of it, but that's not all of it. Like, you know, when you go to these places we call the big cities, they're just, Washington, D.C. is a big city, Detroit's a big city, Philadelphia's a big city, New York's a big city. These are immense, complicated places. And we think that maybe the fact that we're doing it around geography rather than around soccer moms or, you know, NASCAR dads, but the fact that we've built it around geography means there's more of an understanding that inherently these places are complicated, that there's a lot going on the ground as there is in any community. But you're right. I mean, I think the trap is when we look at these places, when I look at a place that's, say, an exurb, you know, in the typology we have, I expect to see something there. I'm like, well, I bet it moved this much, or I bet the vote looks a little bit like this. But I know it's not always going to look like that because there are outliers. And I think that the data, when you look at, so you look at the data at a big national scope in these numbers, and we talk about the 6-point moves, these 5-point moves, that's the overall thing. But zeroing in on individual places can really keep you humble, because it can really help you see that not all military posts are the same. They're not. Not all exurbs are the same. Not all big cities are the same. And the key thing is you have to allow that these are the national figures, but when you get down to the more granular level, there's differences inside these communities.
That's Dante Cheney, director of the American Communities Project at George Washington University. He's also the author of Our Patchwork Nation. Dante, thanks for making time for us.
Thank you for having me.